So it's really a couple of things. I'm kind of a nerd, and I love when there is an area of knowledge about which a lot of people don't know much. And if there's an area like that, it's death and memorialization history and death and memorialization present. So chock full of very little known facts, just kind of waiting to be mined. So as I started looking into this stuff, I became great at dinner parties because I could talk about the history of embalming or everything that goes into making a funeral. However, as I went on working on the book, I really had to ask myself, okay, why are you really doing this? And I realized, you know, there I was in my late 20s and then early 30s, and I'd never experienced catastrophic loss. And there's no hard and fast answer for what to do when something like that happens to you, when you lose a loved one. So what do we tend to do as human beings but ask folks who have experienced this stuff before to tell us stories about how they got through it or how they at least grappled with it? And so that's what this book has turned into. It's stories of people who find themselves involved with death and memorialization and how they've grappled with it. And I think that's the closest we can get, sharing stories in, you know, situations like this that are so profound and so difficult.
You've written in your book that American attitudes towards death and mourning changed from the late 19th century to the early 20th century. What were some of the characteristics of those changes?
So in the 1800s, people experienced a lot more death than they do today, right? A lot of people's children wouldn't make it to a first year. And then, of course, there was the Civil War in the United States, lots of death there. And through a combination of factors, which I talk about in the book, there was a very huge sort of death culture in the United States and Great Britain in the 19th century. This was the time of long mourning periods. This was the time when cemeteries were invented as places that we would go and visit and actually spend time in and picnic in and plant gardens in. You think of Oakland Cemetery here in Atlanta. Then at the turn of the 20th century, a number of things happened. This was the time when germ theory really came into its own. You saw the rise of hospitals and of funeral homes. And so death was moving from taking place in the home, and funerals were moving from taking place in the home to moving out of the home and handled by strangers who were not family members. So rather than dying in the home, people would die in hospitals, or people would die in, you know, increasingly as the 20th century rolled on, nursing homes. And we didn't see it happen. And we then did not handle death once it had happened. We turned that over to professionals too, to funeral directors. And as that happened, people became more uncomfortable with the concept of death. It's really funny. I look at etiquette manuals from the 19th century and then from the early 20th century. In the 19th century, when it comes to the chapter on death and etiquette for mourning, it's all about really making sure that you observe it to the fullest. When you look at an etiquette manual from the 1920s, you see advice and admonishments for, you know, don't dwell in your gloom for too long. It makes people uncomfortable. And that's really the main change that we see.
This book is so rich with detail and interesting tidbits about our practices related to dying. Just to pick out a couple. What was hair craft?
In the 1800s, this was sort of the high point of popularity for people giving their sweethearts or their mother's locks of their hair, you know, to remember them by, or just sort of as tokens of affection. And it was really popular to weave that hair into pieces of jewelry. So these might be necklaces. These might be watch fobs. These might even be tiaras that people would wear crafted of their, you know, their brother's, their sweetheart's hair. And then people died a lot more back then, a lot more frequently. So when that person died, that piece of jewelry became a memento to remember that person by. And people wore these things proudly.
One from the modern era, reef balls.
Reef balls, yes.
In 25 words or less, what's a reef ball? It's not an hors d'oeuvre, is it?
It is not an hors d'oeuvre. It is not an hors d'oeuvre that you serve at sea. There's a company in Decatur, Georgia, called Eternal Reefs that will take your loved one's ashes, and you can participate in this. Have them made into artificial coral reefs that they then jettisoned to the bottom of the sea, and which actually grow reefs on them. They work organically and they grow coral reefs on them. And, you know, people choose this option whose loved ones were really involved in seafaring life, maybe Marines, people who loved to scuba dive in life. And this really exemplified the way that people are looking at memorialization today. And I think the way they always have, but it's really clear today that people are looking for options that exemplify how they lived life and things that they loved in life.
You've got a couple of chapters devoted to obituary writers and the professional societies. You pose the question in one of the chapters, and I'm going to quote this. What kind of people come to a conference devoted to writing about the dead? What's the short answer to that? Because I'd like to know.
The kind of people who come to a conference devoted to writing about the dead are people who love reading obituaries. And I bet there are people listening who say, oh, yeah, this is ringing a bell for them. Folks who read obituaries in different newspapers across the country every day. And when I say obituaries, I'm not just talking about the penned stories of famous people. I'm talking about the journalist penned profiles of non-famous people that we see in papers across the country. In the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, they do them here. And I talked with Kay Powell, who is a retired obituary writer for the AJC. She used to pen such beautiful profiles.
As someone who is interested in the dead, or stories about the dead, customs.
Thank you. I'm not really,
okay.
You know.
I know. Would you want to be an obit writer? Have you written any obituaries?
I have never written any obituaries. That's an interesting question, Steve. You know, I've not really considered it. It's a great responsibility. And certainly in my radio work, I love doing profiles of people. If you look up my name on WAB's website, you'll see lots of profiles of folks. And in writing this book, I really felt the weight of the responsibility of writing about the lives of people that I talked with. You know, I went back and fact-checked with each of them, because you want to make sure that when they see themselves on the page, they can recognize themselves in those words. You know, something I've never considered. Maybe I'd consider obituary writing. It seems like it's certainly a high pressure job, because these are folks who begin the day with name, cause of death, and that's about it. And then by the end of the day, they're responsible for creating this fully fleshed out story that makes the reader feel like she really knows this person. And that's a lot of work, and that's, you know, that is not a responsibility to be taken lightly.
My fear is that when I pass on, what if they have some sort of headline that says, you know, loved bingo, or, you know.
Is that true, Steve? Do
no,
you
it's
love
not.
Bingo?
No, but you know what I'm saying? That's what's left. After 80 or 90 years, that's all you can say? The guy liked bingo?
Right. I mean,
with all due respect to people who like bingo, but, you know, I'm thinking there must be more to life than that.
Right. I think a lot of people are asking that question right now, actually. We're seeing sort of a rise right now in conversations about end-of-life issues, and I think that we can attribute that to the baby boomer generation. This is the generation that really made a lot of changes in the world, a very active generation. And aside from social change, you know, these were the folks who reinvented things like the home birth and invented getting married on the beach and really wanted to reinvent rites of passage for themselves to do the way that they wanted to do them. And now that these folks are approaching that very last rite of passage, they're questioning that too, and they want to do that the way they want to do it. So we've seen the rise of hospice. We've seen the rise of things like palliative care. These are folks who've often experienced the deaths of their own parents, and they've seen the way that it sort of happened to them, and they're now saying, oh, gee, you know, I really want a lot more control over this. And so they're looking at, you know, memorialization options that really speak to who they feel they are as a person and how they want to be remembered.
Dealing with the departed has really evolved quite a bit in the last half century or so. Cremations, I think you point out, account for about 40% of disposals. Is that the right word? Can I frame
disposals
it?
Disposals is a word they use. And okay. Last I heard it was around 35%, but rising.
But how popular they are, you found, is linked to education level in some areas.
This is something that a funeral director told me, that apparently the higher the education levels in a geographic region, the more cremation you'll see. And I haven't done any analysis on that, but it's kind of interesting. And it would be an interesting analysis to do.
Since the 70s, recycling has gained wide acceptance. I mean, plastics and glass bottles, cooking oil, paper.
Bodies.
Yes. And now people. You've got a chapter in what are called green burials. Is that just another curious fad of the late 20th, early 21st century? Or do you see this as something that's going to catch on?
You know, one interesting thing in looking at that question is when I first started following the phenomenon of green burials, and what I mean by green burials are ecologically friendly burials. So this is burial without anything that doesn't biodegrade down to nothing. So no metal clasps on caskets, no embalming fluid. A lot of folks choose to get buried just in a simple wooden box or maybe in a shroud. There's a green burial cemetery in Conyers, Georgia. The one that I profile in the book is Ramsey Creek Preserve in South Carolina. When I first started following this phenomenon in 2007, there were, I think, 4 green burial cemeteries in the United States. When I followed up with Joe Sahey, the former director of the Green Burial Council in 2013, he told me there were 40 green burial cemeteries in the United States. So that certainly tells us that this is at least a trend and something that people are very interested in. Again, we're talking about the boomer generation, and these are folks who, you know, maybe have had more of an interest in environmental issues and questions of, you know, what kind of impact am I making in ways large and small on this planet?
You've interviewed and told the stories of a variety of people in the dismal trade, which is a great way of phrasing how people deal with the dearly departed, or those who are somehow involved with people who are mourning, a tattoo artist, obit writers, museum curators, photographers of the dead. Any common trait amongst all those folks?
I think one thing that I found with all of these sort of dismal traders that I talked to, whether it was the third generation funeral director or the woman who suddenly found herself selling funeral urns online, who was kind of uncomfortable with the fact that that's what she did for a living. Even people who would have disagreed with one another vehemently about particular issues if you put them in a room together, they were all comfortable with talking about death in a way that a lot of people that I interact with in everyday life are not comfortable. And a lot of them were interested in having conversations about our discomfort with talking about death today here in the early 21st century. So no matter their opinions on the right way to do things, they were all perfectly comfortable with having these discussions.
So how has this experience, writing this book, doing the research, affected your thoughts about your tangible legacy? Mm. What are you going to leave behind besides a copy of the book?
Wow. You know, this writing this book has caused me and my husband and I to think about what our plans are, what our end-of-life plans are. And I think that as somebody in my 30s, there's no way I would have thought to, you know, make a living will or to, you know, actually plan for our own memorial in my mid-30s. What American in their mid-30s really thinks about that really commonly? But this book has caused me to do that, to realize, you know, this is going to happen. I have decided, actually, though, you know, not to really disclose publicly what those specific memorial plans are, because, you know, the interesting thing that I learned while doing this book is that there are strong camps. People believe that, you know, for example, doing a traditional funeral with embalming, that's the right way to go. Or people believe that cremation is the right way to go, or green burial is the right way to go. And I support every single one of those, because these are decisions, you know, they're deeply personal. And when people give their rationales for them, it really makes sense for that person in that moment.
Kate Sweeney is the author of American Afterlife, a colleague of mine here at WABE. Subtitle: Encounters in the Customs of Mourning. Love this book, Kate. Thank you.
Thank you so much.